Video podcast, Richard Gage, 9/11 Unleashed. Welcome to the video podcast, Richard Gage, 9/11 Unleashed, where truth and unity matter. Take the deep dive with highly influential voices in and around the 9/11 truth movement.
And welcome everybody to our live video podcast, Richard Gage 9/11 Unleashed. And I want to bring in my lovely assistant and wonderful wife, Gail. Hi, Gail.
Hello, Richard, and hello, everybody. I'm not on camera video today because we are in a unique situation where we're saving all of our bandwidth for.
And guess what? Our new guest, Mr. Mark Lilly, who I'll be introducing in just a moment. Before we do, Gail, what were you saying yesterday when we had our issues with our bandwidth? Not our bandwidth, but the bandwidth down in Kerrywood, Idaho, where our guest Mark Lilly is from. You were sharing some important things that you were working on before we bring on our esteemed guest. Share that with us.
Yes, one of those things is because of Richard leaving AE and going on his own, there's a lot of people who were following him.
In quotes.
Yeah, exactly.
You can learn more, by the way, about the leaving of AE on our website, which is richardgage911.org, where there's a podcast and a letter about that situation.
That's
you can learn
right.
more. Go ahead. Sorry to interrupt you, dear.
No, that's all right. No problem. That's right. So because of that, a lot of people think that Richard is still with AE, 9/11 Truth. And so I've been going on a lot of social media and sending out a lot of friends requests to people who are not already either Richard's friend on Facebook on his personal account or following him on his public account. So that should help let a lot of people know. But all of you folks out there can help us also by you sharing and you posting, you know, everyone you know who is in the 9/11 Truth Movement or even, you know, anybody at all, please send the website, which is richardgage911.org. And also tell them about the podcast that we do on social media. And we have on the website, there's lots of opportunities for volunteers, which that was the other announcement I was making last night is for all of you wonderful people who have signed up as volunteers on the website. There is a form. If you go to the main page, the home page of the website, over on the right-hand side, there's actions that drops down with a volunteer form that you can fill out that tells us something about you. But I'm going to be reaching out personally to everyone who has filled out a volunteer form on the website so that I can make a personal connection with you, kind of get to know you a little bit, and we can discuss where you may be able to help us here at Richard Gage 9/11.
And there's other ways you can help us, too, because we've got a whole mission ahead of us. We're making a new film, and that film is called 9/11 Crime Scene to Courtroom. And this is you'll see it right there on the website, richardgage911.org. This is the film that the 20th anniversary of 9/11 was made for. I mean, this is the Lawyers Committee for 9/11 Inquiry teaming up with myself to bring forth the evidence to the grand jury. This is an incredible opportunity, and we have already raised $40,000 for this film, and it's a $120,000 budget, so we've got more to do. So we want to encourage you all to take a look at that film and also join the family of sustaining supporters at AE 9/11 Truth. And without further ado, how do people ask questions on from our audience today?
Yeah. What you can do is whichever social media you're on, Facebook and YouTube. I don't think we can get comments from Twitter or LinkedIn or the others yet, but we're working on it. So below the videos in the comments section, just put your questions in there. It comes up on StreamYard in the little comments box, and I copy it over so that I can ask those questions of our guest and of Richard. So I always say, please know that if I don't get to your question, don't think that I left you out or forgot. I can only get so many, and know also that there is no such thing as a bad question. They're all good questions, and I will try to get all of them. And a little side note about the volunteers, those of you who have filled out a form with your contact information, I am going to be calling people on Saturday, this coming Saturday, to touch base and connect with you. So if you haven't already signed up as a volunteer and you'd like to, please do that by Saturday so that I can reach out to you and we can have a conversation.
Yay. And without further ado, I already said that. We're going to introduce our
Richard Gage 911 Unleashed. We'll be on the air again next.
We'll fix that. But here's the question. How does an explosive expert look at the collapse of three skyscrapers on 9/11? What does he see that we don't? What does the evidence reveal to him? What really is an explosive versus a propellant versus a pyrotechnic and an incendiary? How and where are they used? My guest is Mark Lilly, an engineer of explosives and the like for more than 30 years. He has designed devices in high-profile programs such as the MX Peacekeeper and Trident V ballistic missile programs, as well as the Space Shuttle solid-fuel rocket booster. He's invented novel commercial blasting agents and has set off millions of pounds of explosives, performing everything from small-scale test shots to million-pound mine production shots. So don't piss him off during the Q&A, please. We don't want him going off. And anyway, Mark holds a degree in chemical engineering from Arizona State University, where he also performed graduate-level research. He specialized in the development and manufacture of propellants, explosives, pyrotechnics, and explosive devices with DOD contracts for decades. He worked at Takata as an engineering manager. It was in this capacity that he challenged the introduction of Takata's ammonium nitrate-based airbag inflator propellants as being unsafe and became a whistleblower. He returned to DOD contracting for the final phase of his explosive career. No pun intended, I'm sure. Managing a large-scale demilitarization program at Fort Wingate Army Depot, it is my great pleasure to bring to you today on Richard Gage 9/11 Unleashed, Mr. Mark Lilly. And here he is there. Hi, Mark.
Hi, Richard. Good to be with you.
Awesome to be with you. And Mark is in studio today, if you ever have a chance to hear his voice. There you are. We're delighted to have you here. Hey, Mark, tell us, first of all, where were you on 9/11? And then how did you find out the truth about 9/11? How long did it take you? It took me 5 years.
Well, on 9/11, I was actually managing the demilitarization program at Fort Wingate Army Depot, and we were doing a routine Pentagon audit on the contracts and so forth, and happened to have three gentlemen with us who were housed, or their offices were, in the area of the Pentagon that was hit. So we were very strongly emotionally impacted by that. You know, our first orders were to lock the base down and increase security. The guests that we had were frantically trying to find out whether or not their colleagues, the person, say, in the next cubicle, was dead or alive. So we had several days of kind of panic reaction. And even though I have the expertise to evaluate, I, like a lot of other people, got sucked into the narrative, the mainstream narrative, and had to believe that it had to have happened the way they said it happened, just because someone in authority told me that. And in this case, it was actually not just the press, but it was coming down through command authority as well. And it took me a number of years. I suppose it was 4 or 5 years, about like you. And my brother started working on me. My brother saw the problems with it and finally got me to look into it. And I think for the first several years, I didn't do anything to investigate. I just accepted the party line. And once I started looking at it, I found more and more inconsistencies with the official story. And what really broke the dam for me was reviewing the video of Building 7, which is the third tower. And I would venture to say probably 80 or 90% of Americans think there were only two buildings that fell that day. And they forget about Building 7, the third building that fell.
Well, most architects and engineers never even knew about this third building you're talking about. By the way, for those who don't know, it's the third worst structural failure in modern history. And not one of us in the American Institute of Architects, 90,000 members, got not even one bulletin about this catastrophic failure of this building that wasn't even hit by a plane. And yet it goes down just like the old hotels in Las Vegas. So how did you come to see that that collapse, if you will, Mark?
Well, it is so incredibly improbable that
what are the conditions where you actually came to see it physically collapsing on a video? I mean, what brought you to that? Did somebody share it with you or what?
My brother had discussed it with me. He had shared some links with me. And I think I just did a web search, to recover some of those links. And, at the time, the videos were still fairly available out on the web.
Okay. And so you're looking at this building going down. Tell me your thought process as an explosives engineer.
Well, my thought process, first of all, is that it is incredibly improbable for a 54-story building or something like that to fall vertically straight down without veering from one side to the other and tipping over. In demolition work, you put meticulous effort into that, and the odds of that happening are pretty remote. Obviously, the odds of it happening three times on the same day are even more remote. but that's your first tip off, and you don't need to be an explosives expert to see that something is off there.
Uh-huh. Okay. Well, where do you go? What happened next? I mean, what did you do with this new information?
Well, I started looking more at the Building 7 collapse. And it became evident that the stories below the fall line, if you will, below the roof line, were collapsing before the material above them got to them. And you start to see things that look like a controlled demolition. Then you start looking at the two larger towers, the North and South towers. And you see funny things. You see expulsions of particulate material going horizontally away from the building. And those expulsions of material are far ahead. They're many floors ahead of where the fall is occurring. So it's not something being squeezed out like an accordion. This is really, really, really starting to look like there are demolition charges set around the outer edge there.
Gotcha. So your curiosity's peaked. You're still in the military at this time?
No, I'm a DOD contractor at this time. So I'm a civilian contractor. The things that are either politically or physically dangerous, DOD gives to contractors because we're far more expendable.
I see. Okay. So you started talking to people. What was it like talking to fellow contractors for the military? Is there anybody who agreed with you or was curious at least?
Well, in talking to people that had actual hands-on explosive experience, EOD guys and that sort of thing, most of them looked at it and said, yeah, you know, I think you're right. So there was a lot of confirmation from the hands-on people. The back office people, not so much.
I see. Okay, so let's go back to basics. Take us to chemistry 101, kindergarten level. What is an explosive?
Well, an explosive is any material that produces gas very, very rapidly and or burns in such a rapid manner that it's producing some sort of a shockwave or a concussion. Generally, in explosives, you divide that up into propellants, explosives, pyrotechnics, and I think you added on in incendiaries, which really are kind of a subset of pyrotechnics.
Okay, so let's go into it a little more. I'm going to give you some time here. Explain the difference between those four items. Explosives expand through gas rapidly, and therefore they knock things over, right? That's what the way Niels Harrit describes it. So is that high energy explosives like C4 and RDX? And are there others?
Oh, there are dozens and hundreds and thousands of explosives that have been invented. But first of all, you want to break them into two categories. And this becomes a matter of how many angels can dance on the head of a pin for some people. But there are explosives that detonate. There are explosives that deflagrate. And the rote answer to the difference there is a detonation is an explosion where the speed of the explosion progresses through the material faster than the speed of sound in that material, whereas a deflagration is subsonic. It's still producing a big bang, but it is not breaking the sound barrier, if you will. If you look at very, very large explosions, for instance, the things that you would see on the news coverage of Desert Storm or that sort of thing, you see that circular shock wave moving out from the center of the explosion. That's moving at more than the speed of sound. So you have deflagration, you have detonation, and then generally within the explosives family, the three or the four types really indicate what you want to do with it. So a propellant is designed to produce a lot of gas. And as the name would imply, it is to propel things. So the gunpowder that you put in, a rifle cartridge is a propellant. When the primer goes off, it ignites the propellant that produces a lot of gas very quickly, pressurizes the chamber, that air or gas pressure pushes the projectile down barrel, and hopefully you hit your target. So propellants produce a lot of gas. Explosives that are not propellants are designed generally to do more damage. They're generally going the military world, they're generally going to be high explosives. They're going to detonate, and the brisance, the sharpness of these explosions, very often will produce fragments of the steel casing the explosives are in, or surrounding materials, cars, whatever. And in explosive events, the shrapnel does far more damage and can do damage at a much further distance than the pressure wave can. You produce a pressure wave that, if you're close enough to it, will crush your chest and will kill you. If you're further away, it might break your eardrums. But that's the general scheme there. Pyrotechnics are intended to produce light, either visible light or infrared light or ultraviolet light. We use infrared pyrotechnics as decoys for missiles that are infrared homing missiles, that sort of thing. You know, when you light some of the 4th of July fireworks, those are going to be pyrotechnics. You see you don't see that because you're probably not in that world. I was going to say
I don't know that I want to be either.
You actually do. It's fun. Yeah. You know, if you survive it, it's really a lot of fun. You know.
Yeah. Show people your hand, Mark.
Okay. That's my pedigree there. Now
tell us what happened.
I was a 15-year-old budding explosive chemist, had never taken a chemistry course in my life, miraculously, this had been in my pocket just a few seconds before it went off, and what I'm going to call divine intervention, I had the foresight to take it out of my pocket, put it into my right hand, then from my right hand to my left hand, and I was going to throw it in the bushes, and then I stopped and it went off. So they pretty much thought I was dead at that point.
But so it wasn't just your hand. It damaged your body too.
Long story, but the emergency room, I'll tell you the whole story if you want. Not a bad story, but you know, we probably ought to go other places.
It hurt you badly. So that was that a pyrotechnic or an explosive or a propellant or an incendiary?
That was an explosive. And we did not understand compatibility. And what we would actually do is take scrap material, wrap it up in paper and duct tape, fuse it, bury it in the sand, and get rid of it. Safest way to get rid of explosives. And we had scrap from multiple different things. Two of the scrap materials were incompatible with each other, and so they went off spontaneously.
This is you as a teenager.
15 years old.
So what were you doing? Did your dad put you up to this? How'd you get involved in explosives as a 15-year-old?
Well, I had a friend, and he was really my friend because I really liked his sister. You know how those things go, right? So he had built those Estes model rockets, and he had built a Saturn V, an Apollo rocket, and the cost to buy engines, the rocket engines they sell you for those models, was really prohibitive for a couple of teenage boys without full-time jobs. So we decided we'd go off and try to make our own, and we did. And so we made rocket motors, and then we made firecrackers and cherry bombs and smoke bombs, and we were not terrorists. The only person that ever got hurt was me. Today, I don't know, I'd probably see a Homeland Security force on my doorstep, but they did send the bomb squad to my room, and the bomb squad removed a number of articles from my closet.
My God. All right, so you learned early to be a little bit safer and not get hurt. You went right in engineering. You went right into explosives, or is this chemical engineering first, and you got into explosives later?
Right. My degree is in chemical engineering, and my early research work was in high temperature chemistry. Fluidized bed pyrolysis. And what we actually were able to do is take any biomass. It could be, waste from your yard or walnut shells or whatever, any biological matter, basically put it in one end and get out of the other end liquid grade transportation fuels, gasoline, diesel fuel, jet fuel, and so forth. And then we expanded that to, if we took in hazardous material on the front end, and we could get paid to take the hazardous material and get paid for the product, that'd be even better. And as it happened, some PhD types from Lawrence Livermore Labs were looking for a way to destroy high explosive waste that they had, and contracted us to do some work for them. And that got me back into back into that world. And then I was actually recruited by Thiokol, who unfortunately don't exist anymore, known mostly for the solid rocket motor for the space shuttle, but Thiokol also built all of the first stage ballistic missile motors, every nozzle that was ever used on a manned launch in the free world, and so forth. So huge group, and learned a tremendous amount about the art from those old timers there.
Wow. Okay, now Mark, you spent some time looking at some of the evidence very recently, and I happen to have some with us today. I wanted to ask you, what are you seeing in this photo as an explosives expert? We were told this is a gravitational collapse due to airplane impacts damaging columns and the ensuing fires. And yet 20, 30, and even 60 stories below in some of these photos, we have this. We're told these are puffs of air by NIST, but we see solids in them. What do you think is going on here?
Well, that looks very much like the ejecta that you would see from a demolition charge that was placed at or near the wall of the building. There's no reason to believe that it is things pushed out by air from a falling upper story, because it is so far below those stories. That doesn't make sense. And if it was compressed air, I would expect to see all of the windows or most of the windows on a floor pushing out. And why would a floor that is many, many levels below where the collapse action is occurring have ejections before the higher floors would? It just dynamically does not make any sense. You have every reason to believe that that is not a puff of air blowing thing out. The only other thing that you know I can equate it to is a demolition charge.
Okay. Well, let me ask you about this. We've got we're told, you know, that the upper stories, in the case of the North Tower, 15 stories, drove the rest of the building down to the ground. And then destroyed itself. But if that were true, wouldn't we expect to see a section of upper story driving the rest of the building down to the ground? And yet we don't. What are we looking at instead here?
Well, you are seeing the upper stories. They're what is cascaded over the sides there, I believe. the upper story... Right, exactly. You know, the dust there is the upper stories, how do you knock out, you know, a whole box there? What is that? 12 stories high, something like that, right? So, how do you knock out a whole box like that spontaneously and randomly? It doesn't happen, and the symmetry, you know, even though. In the one tower in particular, the aircraft struck well off center, off to one side, yeah. And the upper portion started to lean over, and then it righted itself. It's not going to do that. There's a law of physics that says it's not going to do that without some input from another source.
Right. Well, what might that source be? Do you have any clues? In looking at the North Tower on the left and a known volcanic eruption on the right, is there any similarity here?
That's good. There's quite a matchup there, isn't there? And you know, obviously, in both cases, you have a lot of gas shattering and moving out a huge amount of rock-like material. Of course, the concrete. You know, apparently shattered into rock. And, you know, it's very interesting. if it was a natural organic collapse, I don't think you'd see the very, very fine dust. I would think you would also see chunks of concrete, which just don't really appear to be there in any large quantity.
Yeah, we would be looking for, you know, 100 stories at least of acre size floors that are concrete, 4 and 8 inches thick. And yet down at the bottom of the pile, we don't see those. We see a 2-story pile of twisted steel. I mean, what does it take to do this to concrete?
Well, the brisance involved in that, you have to have a shattering force to do that. So that would imply that it is a high explosive. If you accept the explosive theory, which I do, that would imply that there were high explosives involved in order to shatter that concrete rather than to break it up into larger chunks.
And explain brisance again.
Brisance is basically the speed of the impulse. A very brisant detonation, you'll have a very, very quick rise in pressure and a quick fall off in pressure, as opposed to kind of a long, slow rise in pressure and decline. And that long, slow rise is usually associated with throwing things, and the very quick rise and fall is generally associated with shattering things.
Oh, and you can engineer that to however you want. Well, how about this? These floors that this concrete that we're looking at that's pulverized in midair before it ever develops its kinetic energy and breaks on the ground. We're talking floors of concrete. Every 12 feet in this building as you rise up is 3 or 5,000 pound PSI concrete. How much explosives, and how do you place these explosives such that you can achieve the complete shattering of each floor of concrete to a fine powder, which has been described like an ash?
Well, I think that, you know, the first thing that you're going to do is, and I'm not a demolition expert, but I have supplied explosives to demolition experts, and they let me hang around sometimes and watch their work. So, you know, as one who's observed some of this stuff, you know, you want to go after the, in this case, the core structure, the structure that is supporting everything else. So if I'm doing this, I think I'm planning a tremendous number of charges around that core to eliminate that structural member up the center. And then I've got to place charges at least every several floors around the perimeter to break up the perimeter wall. And that whole episode is definitely, if you believe the explosive theory, it's also an overkill. And somebody really wanted to be sure that all the debris fell pretty much in the footprint of the building.
Well, in this case, almost all of it falls outside the footprint. So I think they, like you said, well, I think they overdid it. I mean, look at the problem here. We have asymmetrical damage from the airplanes, the fires, and the top of this south tower falling off, and yet there seems to be complete symmetrical progression all around the building, like the firefighters described, all four sides. So how can you get that to happen?
Well, first of all, I think I misspoke when I said in the footprint of the building, but directly straight down. And, you know, it did not kick out. You didn't have a section of the building, as you're pointing out, you know, fall and tip over to the side and that sort of thing. So the only way that you're going to do this is with a whole series of explosives at each floor. And those explosions have to be timed. And you know, when people do this type of demolition work, you need timing on the order of 1 or 2 milliseconds precision in order to achieve that kind of a symmetrical fall. And that does not happen in nature. I think in the video you were showing a minute ago, you can also see some of those puffs of ejecta coming out ahead of the cloud that's rolling down the side of the building. It's impossible. Once would be, incredibly unlikely, but to see that in 3 different buildings all in the same day, that can't happen.
Gotcha.
Not naturally.
In fact, down here on the lower left, you can see one of those ejecta right there.
Yes.
How does that happen in a natural collapse? What's that? 4 stories below. What are we seeing here? I mean, get real specific here. You've got an opportunity to educate us about what we're looking at.
Well, it's interesting. As in fact, it's going to be hard to tell you when to freeze it. But in some of those, you actually see that it appears that something at the top of a wall segment is being pushed out a little bit as then the ejecta fly out as well. So it looks like explosives placed not willy-nilly, but deliberately placed at intersections, either where a floor comes together with a roof, or a roof comes together, or a ceiling comes together with a floor, or a floor comes together with a ceiling, to damage the joint holding that together. And so you see some larger pieces coming out. And then you see the shattering of the concrete that seems to have been attached. And I'm not a building engineer. I'm not an architect. I see concrete shattering, and I see larger structures, which I assume are steel, that are being pushed away. And with such a velocity that you're not going to have that occur in a collapse. You would expect to see those structures bow and bend and then kind of give way, not be shot out basically straight horizontal.
Gotcha. Now, Mark, let me ask you to pull your microphone a little bit further away from you, because we're getting some noise and scratchiness.
All right, let's try that.
Much better. Now, this in the lower right corner here, we have the same situation, just from a different angle. This leading edge. Yes. Not to mention things like that are happening, like over here, right there.
Yep.
I mean, this is looped, so you can see it again and again. Is there any possibility to describe this as a natural collapse?
Again, I'm not a structures guy, but I mean, it is part of the core, so but I don't do that for a living. I'm not a professional in that field. But there's nothing in physics that would say that. And as you've pointed out, many have pointed out, there's a constant level of acceleration. Whereas if a collapse started at the top of the building and actually that top actually hit the remaining structure, you would see a decrease in the acceleration rate, if not the decrease in velocity. But here you're seeing what looks like a gravitational fall, because the support beneath the section that is falling is taken out as that upper section is falling into the lower section.
And how many explosions can you count along the way? I mean,
I've never tried, but there had to have been thousands.
But I mean, just looking at this video,
yeah,
right,
one,
here.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. I can't, you know, I can't follow them all. there's got to be at least a dozen just in that loop that are visible.
I've given this presentation to so many people around the world, and they're overwhelmingly at the end of this, they virtually all of them, sometimes there's one or two holdouts, if you will, end up agreeing that we need a new investigation, that this evidence is just startling. I mean, 600 feet away, we have evidence like this, destroying the Winter Gardens. How do you get 4-ton and 8-ton structural steel sections landing 600 feet away from a gravitational collapse that, in this case, the North Tower, WTC-1, destroying the Winter Gardens and these exterior columns in the Verizon building over the top of World Trade Center 6 stuck in the Verizon building? How can you help me?
Well, I'll draw an analogy for you. A lot of that material thrown out that far looks very similar to what we saw as the result of a high explosive dryer accidentally detonating during operation at Fiacol. And those distances that giant pieces of steel were thrown are comparable to what we saw in the accidental detonation of, I can't tell you how much, but several thousands of pounds of HMX, which is an extremely powerful high explosive.
Oh, so you're drawing an analogy here. What do you think what happened here in World Trade Center 6, where we have the entire interior of the building gutted? This is World Trade Center 7. We talked about that, and what, that's the next question. What can cause that? But take it away here.
You know, I haven't looked very much at World Trade Center 6. Years and years ago, when I worked in corporate America, they sent us to management school, and they drilled into our heads, gather enough information to make your decision, but don't waste your time gathering superfluous information. And not that that's something that should be ignored, Building 6, but I haven't spent a lot of time looking at it because I've been convinced from the other three. But just looking at that aerial view, it definitely looks like somebody took the core of that building out. And the only thing that could virtually instantaneously take the core of the building out without bringing the rest of the building down, that I know of, would be explosive charges set along that core.
Well, this is what we brought you here for, so that we could learn something. Let's look at Building 7 here. That looks very different than the World Trade Center, which is, as we saw, its pieces delivered 600 feet radius around each of these towers. An incredible problem for the official story. But Building 7 is this nice, neat implosion, like the old hotels in Las Vegas. Do you have any comments about the differences in the strategy used between each of the used in each of these very different explosive events?
Well, I don't think that the what you see as far as the results of rubble on the ground is certainly not a big conundrum. In the case of the two towers, you had structural damage done by the collision of the planes. And I forget which one it was, but one of them was serious enough that you saw the upper part of the building list over. I think it was in excess of 20 degrees. So when you have that kind of eccentric damage that was unpredictable to, and again, I'm assuming that for the moment anyway, that we accept or at least walk through the idea that it was explosive charges. So assuming that it was explosive charges, the people setting those charges could not know exactly how those aircraft would hit the building. And therefore, with the charges, couldn't compensate fully for the eccentricity of the collisions, the damage due to the collisions. So in the first place, you've got you've got apples and oranges. You've got buildings that were damaged versus a building that wasn't damaged. And of course, the aspect ratio there, the twin towers are much, much higher. And they give you more room for a lateral displacement due to, in other words, an angular displacement of a taller tower produces more lateral displacement than for a shorter building. And the taller it is, the harder it's going to be to control how it comes down. So I don't find it to be a particular conundrum, given the physics of the circumstances. In the case of Building 7, that is a deliberate destruction of the building. That does not happen in nature. No random or pseudo random event due to fire or weakening of the structure due to debris hitting from the other buildings. None of that can account for a perfectly symmetrical collapse of a building. That will not happen in nature, because you're always going to have the weak point go first. And I mean, this is how you bring buildings down. If you want to bring a building down and lean it over to the right, you drop the right charge first and then the left charge second. There's no explanation other than a deliberate destruction of Building 7.
Well, they must have done an exceptional job, because the center of that pile is in the center of the footprint of the building. So there is some damage to the post office and the Verizon building, but my gosh, that would be the tallest building that has been destroyed by controlled demolition ever, and a near perfect job. So hats off to the engineers there, huh?
Yeah, maybe they should put that on their resume.
yeah, really. So let's jump to this set of very visible explosive isolated ejections, is what I call them. What do you call them?
I don't have a better term to describe those. Those are ejections that don't seem to fit the pattern of some of the others that we saw. And I know in some of the eyewitness testimony, they talked about ejecta happening at a given level at a time. Everything went on one level and so forth. Whether that's a misfire, whether that is there's some support structure there that is extraordinarily strong and needed an extra push, I don't know. But that certainly doesn't look like anything you would expect to see from a collapsing building.
Some of them are 60 stories down below the right. What we're told is a collapsing building. So that one threw me for a loop. And we can see, again, these are pretty solid. There's solids coming out of there. These are not puffs of air. The buildings were designed with open office area. That's one of the beautiful engineering feats of this building, where there's 60 feet across by 200 feet long of open office area. So that couldn't explain these highly focalized and geometric ejections either, which in the explosives industry, they call them squibs.
I know I've heard you refer to those as squibs, and that's not a squib.
Okay. Tell me about squibs.
Well, in one sense, it could be called a squib. Generally speaking, a squib is an igniter. In my day, they used to be electric. Now they have some other things, but that is very low power. Doesn't detonate. It's not a detonator. It's an igniter. Now, some of the old guys use the term squib to refer to a charge that did not go off as it was intended to. So in that sense, that might be a squib. But I think of squibs as being an igniter, a non-detonating igniter. But using the older terminology, yeah, maybe you'd call that a squib. It was something that was a misfire. I called it a misfire. Yeah, you might call it a squib. But those ejections look too forceful, too powerful to be... to be shots that did not completely detonate. It looks like maybe they're mistimed, or as I say, I'm not a structural guy. Maybe there's something structural there that just needed to come out at that time in the collapse.
Okay. Well, speaking of the collapse, let's see how fast this building comes down. We got an animation on the right. The actual collapse, if you will, on the left, in a dozen seconds, the buildings are all the way down to the ground. And I've relied on David Chandler to help us with this. Tell me what you think about this after listening. So it's almost falling as fast as a bowling ball falling out of the sky is what he's saying. There's just a little bit of resistance, but it's accelerating is the point. It doesn't slow down whatsoever. It gets faster and faster each floor. Can you comment on that?
Sure. In fact, one of my specialties in academia and after academia was analysis of experimental data. And his curve fit is beautiful. If his straight line that you saw there was any better a fit to the data, I'd say he faked it. I'm not inferring that he did. That's a beautiful curve fit, and it is exactly what he says it is. He did the job right, and that definitely proves his point beyond a shadow of a doubt.
But wait, how can the building fall faster and faster each second when it's going through all of this steel? I mean, that's altogether. There's more than 300 columns. In the building, these exterior ones are 14-inch square steel tube. What has to happen in order for this building to fall that fast?
Well, you asked the question first. How can that happen? How can it? Whoop! I'm sorry, got a little animated there. How can it continue to accelerate when it is plowing through all that steel? And the answer is it cannot.
So what?
And therefore, the logical conclusion was all that steel was out of the way. So how do you move that much steel out of the way ahead of a collapsing a wave, if you will? The only way I know of to move that much material that quickly is with explosives.
Well, what kind of explosives would you use if you were the engineer of this particular job?
Well, like I say, I'm not a demolition guy, but... what I see them do is first they try to weaken the major structures, the support structures, the bones or the skeleton, if you will, of the building. And that's going to be done with used to be done very much with linear cutting charges. I guess nowadays, and I've been retired for a while, so I've been out of the picture a little while, but I guess nowadays they also have some very high speed, high performance materials that are thermites or derivative thermites that will do the same thing, and so you've got to cut that steel, and once you've cut the steel, you can shatter the concrete. I don't need a lot of concussive force. I need to focus that force very narrowly on selected structural members so that I can weaken the members, the sufficient number of members to induce the failure of the structure. But in a case like this where I'm trying to bring them, you know, vertically straight down, the timing has to be impeccable on that. You know, the big demolition guys on a big job like this, I mean, they'll spend months and months working out, you know, exactly how that sequence of timing should go. And as I mentioned earlier, that has to be, you know, the level of precision on that has to be something on the order of, you know, 1 or 2 milliseconds. That takes a lot of planning. That takes a lot of expertise. That is not, you know, Muhammad, whoever, in his backyard stirring something up in a 55-gallon drum.
That's racist.
I'm not making fun of Muslims, but I'm saying that it was blamed on the Muslim hijackers.
Now that is racist.
Took part. They took part on it in it, right? It was blamed on them, and you know, I'm any group like that that's trying to run clandestinely and purchase things off the books, and they can't make the quantity necessary to do that, much less the quality.
Okay, so I tend to agree with you about that. This seems to prove that this is some sort of an inside operation, which we're going to save till the end of our discussion today. But I want everybody to, well, particularly you, Mark, as an explosives expert, I broke this down, and I want to see if you could comment on it. This is one section that's freely flying, and then there's section two, freely flying. Those sections land 300 to 400 feet away. And then here's other freely flying sections. Look at this one here, 1, 2, 3. That is a 45-degree angle. Now, that piece is thrown out at this point, back to the beginning and out and out and out, and then gravity begins to take over and pulls it down. Now, I was taught that gravity works down from the beginning. This is a freely flying structural steel section weighing 4 to 8 tons, as most all of them were in that range. And Mark, it's trailing thick white smoke clouds. Now, we know that steel is not flammable under the conditions of office fires or even jet fuel. It doesn't burn until you get it, you know, like thousands of degrees, which fires and jet fuel can't do. So tell me, what's going on here?
Well, those large pieces obviously got an initial push in the horizontal direction. So you're seeing them just like the trajectory of a bullet or an artillery shell or anything else. You shoot with a single impulse and then it flies ballistically without the use of motors and any other form of propulsion. There's initially obviously a large force pushing out, and that's just not consistent in my mind with you can imagine. There's some deformation of a column, and you get a little spring effect there, and it squeezes out like a watermelon seed kind of thing. But in my mind, I can't see that much force being applied in a straight horizontal direction by any natural collapse mechanism.
Well, okay. Can you explain why it might be trailing thick white smoke clouds, this structural steel?
You know, my impression is that might be, concrete dust that continues to flake off. I don't know that much about the structure, to be able to say that with anything definitive, but it looks like it might be that. I obviously it gives you the impression of some sort of a smoke, but it may just be dropping dust as it goes. I can't say.
So we do know from the work of Niels Harrit that thermite, which is an incendiary, which you can talk about if you would, incendiaries, turns. It has iron oxide and aluminum as its essential ingredients, right? And so can you explain how those ingredients interact and what the byproducts are?
Sure. The basic thermite is simply very, very fine iron oxide, Fe2O3. There are a number of iron oxides and very fine aluminum powder. Now, people have added to that various things to modify the performance, and generally the modified thermites, some people refer to as thermates, and people get into arguments about thermite versus thermate. Doesn't matter. it's all basically the same idea. The one characteristic of a thermite is you have to get it very, very hot to initiate the reaction. The reaction's not going to happen spontaneously. And basically the iron oxide in the Fe2O3 has extra oxygen that it can donate, take it to a lower energy level. So once it starts going, it becomes spontaneous. And you end up with aluminum oxide and iron. So ultimately, if it goes to conclusion, iron oxide and aluminum moves to aluminum oxide and iron. So you're swapping partners at the dance.
Okay. And what would be left behind? I'm told that it's aluminum oxide ash or a cloud of vapor, which Niels Harrit believes is what's responsible for this phenomena that we're looking at here. Is that possible?
If it was continuing to burn, that is absolutely possible. If you look back at the space shuttle, solid rocket motor, that is burning aluminum. It's using ammonium perchlorate as the oxidizer. It's using iron oxide as a burn catalyst in small quantities, and aluminum in kind of a plasticky rubbery binder. That's all that space shuttle motor is. The trick is doing it right. But if you look at the clouds of quote unquote smoke that are left by that solid rocket motor, sure, they look just like that. And if you go on a test range, as I have done, after a test of a solid rocket motor like that, you find just an incredibly fine aluminum oxide dust. Yes.
Gotcha. Okay.
So if it was still burning, yes. If I wanted to take down a building, maybe there's a charge there that didn't light as strongly, and therefore did not burn as quickly as it might have, that was continuing to smolder, if you will, as it went off. Sure, that's entirely possible. He's got a different idea, but his idea is totally plausible when you look at how a thermite might go if it burns slowly.
Okay. Now we talked about the steel being ejected out of the Twin Towers laterally up to 600 feet. Now we found that if that happens, how can it be available? This is one third of the weight of the building is the steel itself. can it be available to crush the building? I mean, this is like not even discussed. What are the other possibilities for crushing this building under the official narrative that it's a gravitational collapse?
Right. As you say, the steel, I think you said was 1/3 plus the weight of the concrete, right? So what is it? That's like 2/3 of the weight being shoved off to the side and not falling there to crush the building. Yeah, that doesn't make any sense that's going to progress that way naturally. No.
Yeah, the concrete was spread in a 3-square-mile area, a 3 inches thick blanket. That's another third, like you said. So that's that's most of the weight of the building that's not even available to crush it. So, you know, when are people going to wake up and get this, I guess is my question. But I don't want you to answer that question. I want you to focus on these fires. You're not a fire protection engineer, but these fires are diminished at the time of the collapse. And yet we're told they're responsible for the weakening of steel and the ensuing near symmetrical collapse of these buildings. Do you have any comments on that?
Well, you know, what you see very obviously there is the black smoke. Whenever you see black smoke from a fire or from an explosion, it means that there's fuel that has not been burned. Some military explosives are deliberately designed that way. So all that black is primarily carbonaceous material that has not been burned. If it has not been burned, that indicates that there was more fuel than there was air, and therefore the fire did not reach, the ultimate peak that it could have had there been a sufficient flow of air. If you looked at and I know you've pointed out also that, of course, the steel structure also conducts heat, away from the source of the flames. If there was ample air, if there was no conduction of material or of heat through the metal material, if there was no convection, then you might make some argument about the fire burning melting the steel. But being as there is conduction, there is convection, and there's obviously a lack of air, so it's a starved combustion, if you will, that fire is not going to reach the, 2600 to 2800 degree Fahrenheit melting temperature, I think, of structural steel.
Well, yeah, and so the official narrative tells us, well, it didn't have to melt the steel. The problem is that it did melt the steel. And part three of the webinar that I've shown describes abundant and overwhelming evidence and shows videos of melted steel and photos of molten steel pouring out of the buckets of the Crab Claw excavators. So if not fire, then what can melt steel?
Well, classically, that's what thermite or thermates are used for. For instance, they're used on railroads to weld sections of rail together in the field. You're out in the middle of nowhere and you need to repair or replace a rail or something. And when you weld, you're melting the two pieces and they fuse together because both sides melt and join together, become one piece. That's a classic application for thermite. How are you going to do that in bulk, in mass? I would say that given that evidence alone, and there's other evidence that I think you'll probably talk about that leads you to think it's thermite. But if you didn't have that other evidence, you would still say there's something more than a fire of office furniture. Yeah, there you go. Yeah, there you go. Yeah, there's more than just burning office furniture that is causing that. And of course, the jet fuel has long since been burned up. So that's not it. And tenants are not allowed to keep hazardous materials, flammable materials, combustibles are kept to a minimum and so forth in those high rises. Could you get some little localized area where it turned into a blast furnace in some little micro climate in there? Sure, maybe you could, but you wouldn't see that large scale melting without they like to call them accelerants. I don't like the term, but some accelerant, something more than you would expect to find in that building. And certainly a good candidate for that is a thermite.
Okay. Well, speaking of that, the FEMA in their initial report before NIST took over did find in their metallurgical examination the silver dollar size holes in WTC-7 steel in the World Trade Center seal. They found a 1-inch column reduced to 1/2-inch thickness and thinned to a paper scroll. Now, we know that fires don't do this, and this is why they did the metallurgical examination on it in the first place. So what do you think is happening here?
Well, fires don't do that, and interestingly enough, a detonation does not do that, and a deflagration does not do that. That one of the things I have in my career investigated several dozen explosive mishaps where, an operating building manufacturing an explosive product, there's an accidental detonation, and you go in and read the tea leaves and try to determine what happened, where it happened, how it happened. The pictures that you're showing are not of a detonation because you would see a very crisp shattering of the steel. They're not a detonation because you would see a bending, not a melting, not a narrowing, although some of it I'm sure was bent in that manner. That looks like there, where we've got pieces punched out. Well, they're not punched out, but pieces, I would say burned out, if I can presume to say that.
Extreme heat.
Yeah, that's got to have been extreme heat that did that. You see the edges are wavy, and they look like they've melted at the edges and then re-solidified. They don't have that sharp break that you would see with a detonation, and they don't have the bending action that you would see in a failure due to a deflagration. So that's extreme heat that did that. And as you say, you can exclude that as having happened on any kind of a large scale. Again, there might be microclimates inside that burning building where it could happen, but not to the extent, to anywhere near the extent that you saw in the evidence that you're showing here now.
Gotcha. Well, I was surprised to learn that you can tell the temperature of molten materials like steel and iron by their color. And so we know that these temperatures are exceeding 2,500 degrees, which office fires and jet fuel can't even get half that, and probably really only a quarter of that. So what can produce these temperatures?
The stock answer would be a highly exothermic reaction, which would lead you to, a thermite or some other form of a pyrotechnic device, and there are others that you might use that are closely related to thermite. That is producing that incredible heat. That's not any different than what we do with decoy flares for the U.S. military. You burn something at a particular temperature to produce a particular color of light to fool the sensor head on the incoming missile, right? So that's all you're doing is burning a pyrotechnic material And you've designed that material in such a way that it burns at a temperature that produces the frequency of light that you want.
Cool. I got to get me one of those because I got people after me. I could use a good decoy. This molten metal sample is 40 pounds of molten metal. I mean, it turns out to be iron, as Stephen Jones found out. And so what is molten iron? We haven't used iron in our skyscrapers for 100 years. What is it doing in the World Trade Center dust? Why in this piece is there manganese and aluminum and sulfur? So it's clearly not airplane or, manganese and fluorine in abundance means it's not airplane. So do you agree that this could point toward very special thermite charges?
Yes, it certainly could. Now, you know, manganese is used in some steels. I don't know the metallurgy that well, you would not expect to see the aluminum, I don't think, in the steels. And I know fluorine, there is some fluorine used in treating steels, in the quantities that you've shown elsewhere, or in the relative abundances, I should say, that you've shown elsewhere, that looks suspicious.
Okay, well, what do you know about 1,3-diphenylpropane? Because the EPA says there's one molecule that present at levels that dwarfed all others, 1,3-diphenylpropane. We've never observed it in any other sampling we've done, and yet it dwarfed the levels. And so what we're told is that sol gel thermite charges would leave behind 1,3-diphenylpropane. Does this make any sense to you?
You know, I don't know much about the sol gel, so I really can't comment on whether you'd expect to see the diphenylpropane or not, or propane, not propene, or not. Maybe that's used in those sol gels. That's not my field.
Gotcha. Okay. Well, I brought you on as a chemical engineer, so I expect you to know everything about chemical engineering.
I know architecture.
I know like this much about architecture. It's an incredibly diverse field. So it turns out that a civil engineer built a thermite cutter charge in his own backyard, and he was able to duplicate the razor thin sharpness that FEMA found in this piece of World Trade Center steel. Any comments about that?
Yeah, that kind of cutting is very characteristic of a thermite charge. It's all consistent with that theory. Yes.
Okay. Well, and then, do you know, have you used shaped cutter charges before? Because this is one that was developed prior to 9/11 for thermite use, for cutting through much thicker sections of steel. And I was just curious if you have any awareness of that.
Us old-timers used shaped charges of conventional explosives, conventional high explosives. And I've not used the thermite charge, but somebody took the idea from a shaped charge of conventional explosive, applied it to the thermite, and hats off. I see a patent there on the screen. I don't know whose patent that is, but hats off to him. That was a very good leap of moving a principle from one technology to another technology, and it must operate basically the same way it would with a conventional explosive. You are concentrating the force, the heat, in the case of a cutting charge, on a very, very small area. It's not the total amount of heat you release, it's the heat per unit area. So if you can take the same amount of heat, squeeze it down into a smaller area, you can cut.
And that's the purpose of a cutter charge, huh?
Yes.
Okay, in this case, thermite-based. Well, then, did you know that the USGS found in their particle atlas in all their World Trade Center studies of the samples of the WTC dust, billions of these previously molten iron microspheres, and which were also found by others, up to 5.6% almost of the dust was molten iron microspheres, about 4 tons of this stuff. RJ Lee Group finds it, and I'm wondering, so many of them, the EPA used it as a signature component, though they had no idea where they came from or how they could arrive. So how do you think they could arrive?
Well, it's and when you say iron, I believe you're using that term advisedly. You don't mean steel, which right. is a mixture of iron and other things. You mean just plain atomic iron. And when you see very small microspheres like that, that was material that was dispersed when it was very, very hot. As you're showing on the screen, it's aerosolization. And so you got the droplets, and then as the droplets fell through the air, they cooled, and they're going to cool in the shape of a sphere. And those very, very small spheres would indicate that the material was moving at a very high rate of speed. If they're not seeing other metals in with it, which would be alloyed with it to make a steel, that sure makes you think it might be iron. And again, I'm using that term advisedly, iron from a thermite reaction where you're turning iron oxide and the iron is donating the oxygen and you get, atomic iron or not at the web, molecular iron, but you get iron, unalloyed iron. Back.
Because they call it Fe spheres. These Fe is pure elemental iron, isn't it?
Right. Yes.
Yeah. So that's not coming from the steel. It's not coming from. They don't know where it came from. That's what blows me away. And yet here's a thermite experiment. What comes out of it is molten iron droplets. I mean, that's the only conclusion I can come to. What about you?
Well, having used thermite charges, not extensively, but having used them from time to time, in the type of burning you saw him doing there, that's exactly what you see is small spheres. If you're close to the ground, the spheres kind of splat and have a flat side on them because they hit the ground before they cooled all the way. But if you drop them through a high enough column of air, they're going to be pretty close to perfect spheres because they will have cooled before they hit the ground. And that's exactly what I have seen using thermite.
Okay. And then the clouds that the first responders were and others were running from was described as being very hot. Willie Rodriguez says his face was burned. His knee was scarred. I think it was a knee. And from extreme heat from the cloud that came in underneath the engine, fire engine that he was hiding under. And the tops of these cars seemed to be toasted. I mean, what in a gravitational collapse, how are you going to get the toasting of the tops of these cars? And what could explain that?
Well, and if you notice in that picture, the cars are toasted, but there's not big visible chunks of debris on top. So it's not like burning couches or something were falling on top of the cars. So it appears that it was a rain of, very hot, finely divided material, which would correspond with the theory that you had. Billions and billions of these hot microspheres and other ash, if you will, falling. It wouldn't just be iron, but you've got hot ash similar to a volcanic explosion.
Gotcha. Well, I'm told by Gail that there are indeed some people who have questions, probably a lot of them for you. Would you be willing to take some questions from our audience?
Sure. And you know, if I don't know the answer, I'll just make one up. No, I'm kidding. Yes. No, more than happy to answer any and all questions.
Hey, cool. Gail, are you online?
I sure am.
Hey, great. What do you got for us?
All right. I have the first questions from Ray. He asks, what is the difference between a detonation and a deflagration? I'm not sure if I'm saying that correctly. Why is jet fuel classified as a flammable liquid and not as an explosive? How does jet fuel behave in a plane crash? A lot of good questions there.
Okay, I can certainly bite on the first two parts there. Difference between a detonation and a deflagration, the stock answer. And this is one of those questions that people that... PhDs that research this for a living, you know, can argue about the technicalities for decades. But fundamentally, a detonation is an explosion where the explosion propagates through the media faster than the speed of sound, and a deflagration, it propagates slower than the speed of sound.
Why would that be important?
Well, it's important because when you get faster than the speed of sound, then you do much more shattering. And when you're slower than the speed of sound, it tends to be, you have an overpressure, but the peak to trough spike is not as sharp, even though the total amount of energy released might be the same, but it's not released in as brief a period of time. So that's detonation and deflagration. What was the second part, Gail?
Why is jet fuel classified as a flammable liquid and not as an explosive?
Jet fuel in and of itself is just what it says. It's a fuel. If you look at the fire triangle, it takes three things to have a fire, right? You need heat, you need fuel, and you need oxygen. Right. So the jet fuel is only one part of that. It is the fuel without the oxygen present. So if it was fuel plus an oxygen, then and it burned fast enough, you know, then you might consider it an explosive. But because there is no oxidizer with it, it is merely a fuel.
Okay. And then the last part of his question was, how does jet fuel behave in a plane crash?
It burns. I'm losing my headset again, but I'm certainly not an expert on plane crashes. But if you look at plane crashes, you know, where jet fuel has been ignited, there's a huge flame. Jet fuel is simply highly refined kerosene. So it's not magic. It's the same thing you burn in your kerosene lamp, but it's very pure. And you see a huge fireball. Very often you'll see then black smoke, which may be secondary materials burning, or maybe some of the kerosene that's only partially burning. But any film I've ever seen of a plane crash, if it burns, it burns, and it does not explode in any way.
Cool. All right. Thank you. This next question is from Lawrence. He asks, what other explosives do you know of that are capable of getting these results?
Lawrence, the question would be, what results? Because we've described an awful lot of results tonight. But you go right ahead, Mark. Take a few of them to shoot.
Well, Lawrence, if you've got a few hours, I'll pull out the Encyclopedia of Explosives, which I own. It's 12 volumes. It's 12 volumes. And that should tell you something. People have been incredibly inventive in developing explosives. You know, the cutting type things would be some thermite, some thermate, but there are literally hundreds, if not thousands, of variations, modifications, variations on a theme, if you would. Now, you know, typically in that type of work, you would also use, along with some of that, you would also use high explosives, So you might use, an HMX, an RDX, HMX being Her Majesty's explosive, RDX Research Department explosive, real close, one the Brits invented, one we invented. At least that's the story they told me. You could use a C4, a plasticized type explosive. And again, in the plastiques, there are so many different variations. But I would look for a plasticized explosive and a thermite or a thermate type explosive to do this type of thing. By the way, some of the conventional explosives might have aluminum in them as well.
Awesome. And this question is from RM. He asks, why aren't demolition experts coming forward to support all this evidence and information available?
Yeah, Mark.
Well, RM, thanks for the question. A lot of them don't have the luxury, first of all, that I have of being retired. So I don't have to worry about losing my job because I said something that was politically incorrect and unacceptable to the mainstream.
You didn't speak out more when you were first finding out about this?
Well, I actually didn't have... now I'm going to tell tales out of school here, but I actually didn't really have a platform to do that on, Richard, until I met you one day at a community meeting. Yeah. So we actually live fairly close to each other, and we're both part of a community service group.
Well, but some of us are compelled to talk to our family members, our colleagues, our neighbors. Did you avoid that in the beginning when you were working for the federal government, or even as a contractor?
You're careful who you speak with. There are some people that you know will accept that kind of thing and consider it. There's others that, quite frankly, would blackball you if you were to bring that up. But I think people that are currently in the business, and I think. Probably you're speaking about whether the Lazos or whatever the name is, there's half a dozen or so big firms that do this kind of work. They don't want to be ostracized. They don't want to lose business or be marginalized by the mainstream establishment for putting forward a theory that's not consistent with the government's accepted theory. Mm.
Makes sense.
Awesome. Okay, this is from Ray. Nanothermites are used as additives in propellants, high explosives, and even airbag ignition materials. Can you explain how nanothermites are used in these applications as additives?
Hi, Ray. Some of the ingredients might be used in other explosives. For instance, aluminum is put into conventional explosives to modify the performance of the explosion. Has been since before the turn of the 20th century. Nanothermite per se. After leaving the defense industry the first time, I went to work in the airbag industry. And then after becoming a whistleblower in the airbag industry, I went back to the defense industry. I'm not aware of anybody using nanothermite per se as a separate ingredient. They certainly use iron oxide. The original airbag propellant, the thing that produces the gas that fills your bag, was iron oxide and mixed with another oxidizer. And so, yes, iron oxide it was very widely used. It turned out it was iron oxide, sodium azide, and an oxidizer. And then there's some toxicity problems there, and the industry's gotten away from that. So certainly you see iron oxide used there. You might see some aluminized mixes. So I think you see some of the ingredients, but to have a discrete section that is a nanothermite, nobody on an industrial scale other than for the U.S. government, really can afford to play too much with large volumes of nanomaterials. So I, per se, I kind of question that that's happening. Now, I've been out of the industry for a few years. Maybe maybe something's happened that, that I don't know of. But I think what you're seeing is that the many of the ingredients are used in those other devices, which is certainly true.
Now, you mentioned, Mark, the airbag. A lot of people don't know that you were a central figure in the scandal. I'm not going to tie you to the scandal, but you were a whistleblower of, which turned out to be a scandal, at Takata. Can you describe what happened there and your role in it?
Sure. Now, Takata was a manufacturer of airbag inflators, which is the canister that has a propellant in it that when it is lit produces gas very quickly, puts the gas in your bag. And in fact, before their demise, they produced about one third of the inflators and airbag assemblies in the entire world. I went to Takata, to work for Takata and initially as a senior engineer. Eventually was promoted to engineering manager, and Takata rolled out a new propellant that they deny this, but I'll tell you quite clearly and without fear of contradiction by anybody but Takata, that they did it to reduce costs. The raw material cost of the new propellant was about one-tenth of the raw material cost of the old propellant. And they were going broke making the old propellant because of the raw material cost. I know. I was there. I did the engineering studies. I presented that data to Mr. Takata himself, old Mr. Takata. So you know, I was there. I was sitting in the seats. When they developed this low-cost propellant, it had an ammonium nitrate base. Ammonium nitrate has a lot of properties which make it unsuitable for long-term storage in an explosive. And I won't go into the details, that would take an hour, but it's not suitable and it degrades under long-term storage, both due to humidity and due to temperature cycling. The heat of the day, the cold of night, the heat of summer, the cold of winter, and so forth. I objected to it. My objections went all the way up to board members in Tokyo. And the answer basically was, yeah, okay, we hear you, but we're going to do it anyway. I spent six, 9 months trying to persuade the leadership there, trying to slow the project down, trying to throw monkey wrenches in the works, was unable to stop it and decided I didn't want to be part of it and left, went back to decontracting. When they started seeing failures, I picked up the phone, called the Senate Commerce Committee, who has jurisdiction over that, found some Senate staffers that were amazing. That we had, you know, hours and hours and hours of phone calls explaining what happened. That story migrated to the New York Times. I was the first person that was willing to put their name and their face out there. Nobody else was willing to be named publicly about it. And I feel it's a matter of professional ethics. If you're aware of a hazard that the ordinary person isn't aware of, I think you've got an ethical responsibility to warn. Anyway, it resulted in a billion-dollar recall effort, Takata is no more. Unfortunately, there were a lot of really good people that I worked with that had nothing to do with Takata's fraud that unfortunately lost their positions. But we were able to stop the profligation of airbags that were literally exploding in people's faces and shooting shrapnel into their neck and their face and their eyes and so forth.
Wow. Sounds like you might yourself need one of those pyrotechnic decoy devices. These guys over in Japan, you know, they can be quite retribution oriented.
I had some interesting interactions with some lawyers that were acting for Takata, but not disclosing that they were acting for Takata. So, it wasn't physical threats, but there were some legal shenanigans that went on.
Oh gosh. Okay, Gail, more questions?
Yes. Okay. This is from Anthony. How does Mark feel about the political climate and the appetite for 9/11 truth right now?
There you go.
Hi, Anthony. Okay, I'm allowed to answer, right? Because he asked.
Yes.
Okay.
You got the floor.
Thank you for that question.
I'm just going to go like this.
Yeah. Thank you. I'll preface my answer, Anthony, by telling you that this response is strictly my opinion, not the opinion of AE 9/11, not the opinion of Richard Gage or anybody else. This is just my opinion. You asked for me, So I hope that people are starting to see the common thread of something happening. You're told that it's something that it isn't, and I believe the term is gaslighting. And we saw this with the JFK assassination. We saw this with the Gulf of Tonkin incident. We saw it, of course, with 9/11. We are seeing with aspects of the the virus issue. And I think people are starting to wake up to the fact that we are the victims of operant conditioning. If I know how you think and I can control the inputs, then I know how you're going to react. So I can control how you react by understanding your computer, your brain, knowing the algorithm, if you will, that you think by, and then controlling the inputs. And certainly with the recent health issue, and because this might go on a platform that doesn't allow me to say it any more explicitly, I think you'll understand what I'm talking about, Ray. I think people are starting to realize that, there is a concerted effort to censor aspects of the story that are not favored by the powers that be, and to accentuate parts of the story that are favored by them. And I will go one further, and I hope I don't offend a lot of people in the audience, but I can say the same for climate change. We may or may not have anthropomorphic climate change. It may or may not be existing. I don't know, because the data have been falsified, and that's been demonstrated. And as an experimentalist, as a scientist, and this is part of my formal training, it was pounded into our head, if the data coming in are no good, the answer going out is no good. So long answer to a short question, Anthony, but I sure hope that people start seeing the connections there and start thinking about things like 9/11 more critically, and maybe re-examine things that they haven't thought about for a while, and see if the evidence really supported that, or if you were buffaloed into the herd position.
Well, having said that, how do you personally break through the resistance that you have with colleagues or family or neighbors? Or do you have any specific example success stories?
She won't watch this podcast, so I can say this. I guess my biggest success story would be with my wife, who she grew up in a very conventional household where her father did sales work, and so the order of the day was don't upset the apple cart, don't say anything that would offend anybody, or just keep your opinions to yourself and talk about the golf match or whatever else it was. And so she grew up in a kind of an information repressed environment. It just takes some with in our case anyway, some persistence. And then when a piece of evidence comes to light that's from a third party, a mainstream source even, you bring that piece to the attention of the person. And because it didn't come from you, it came from, you know, NBC or CBS or, you know, public radio or whoever it was. And those things do leak out from time to time. That helps them bridge the gap, in my experience, between what they believe is incredible and what really is happening in the real world.
Right. Well, we hope we can take a piece of that home, because each of us talk to people in our worlds, and we want to help them to see what is true about 9/11 and what's false. And it's a compelling force inside of us to do that. And I'm always looking for the keys that will help. Gail, is there more, another question for our guests?
There are several more questions. The next one is from Ray. He asks, nanothermite consists of a fuel and oxidizer. How does nanothermite react when used in a jet fuel-rich environment? Does nanothermite enhance the combustion of the jet fuel as an oxidizer?
Well, I think you asked that one later, but you might have another reflection on earlier. But Mark, you might have another reflection on that.
Well, no, actually, the other question I think was slightly different, I see where you're what you're thinking, Ray. typically in a thermite, you're going to have I'm going to use a fancy word, a stoichiometric blend. In other words, you have enough of part A to react with part B, but not very much more of part A than you have what's needed to react with part B. So, you know, the quantities are pretty well matched, oxidizer to fuel. You might be a little rich on one or the other. It's not going to itself probably contribute excess oxidizer. It might, but that's probably not going to be a significant thing. But you are onto something in that it is an incredibly intense and hot flame. And with anything, the more intensely you light it, the faster it's going to respond. Works with explosives, and it works to a lesser degree with fuels. So if you had nanothermite, and this is going to be now a jet fuel that is somewhat aerosolized, it's dispersed in droplets in the air, inside a floor. I'm trying to get inside your head, but I think this is what you're thinking. The ignition of the nanothermite might cause a more violent onset of the fire of the jet fuel. You're onto something there, Ray. Yes.
Interesting. Yeah, because we know that thermite has to be started with extremely hot temperatures. I assume it's the same for nanothermite.
Nanothermite should, in theory, be a little easier to light, but it's still going to have a very high temperature.
Okay. This question is from Diana. She asks, could people standing in windows have been blown out by initial explosives? She's referring to the people that did not jump intentionally. Also, were bodies blown up by explosives from the core of the building?
Hi, Diana. I would suppose, yes, could that happen? Yeah, it certainly could happen. I can't say whether it did happen or it didn't happen. I don't know that you could ever reconstruct things. This is gory, but, you know, from what I understand, there really wasn't a lot left to examine of a lot of the bodies.
Well, 1,000 of them were completely the people. There's no trace of them. I mean, they were vaporized. So what does that?
Right. I was trying to be gentle, but yes.
Sorry.
So, you know, there's probably not enough physical evidence that ever existed to determine whether somebody was or was not blown out a window. Could it happen? Sure, it could. That overpressure is that blows out the window could blow a person out the window. I wouldn't expect. Well. I'll go back to a mishap that occurred at Thiokol, where a rocket motor composed of material reasonably similar to the nanothermite. It was burning aluminum primarily. Did go off, and you saw there were five people there that day standing on top of it when it went off, and you saw their bodies fly, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of feet. So yeah, it can happen. And by the way, in case somebody's wondering, yes, you do get blown out of your shoes. It does happen.
And realize this, that we have body parts, those that they did find. Again, a third of them they didn't even find, a third of the 3,000 people murdered here. Some that they did find were found 800 feet outside the perimeter of the Twin Towers. And there were 20,000 pieces of bodies that were small enough to fit into a test tube. I mean, way 800 feet outside these two Twin Towers.
Well, and Richard, I just want to stop for a minute there. You know, it's if you've never seen the results of that happening, you can say that in a very calculated and a distance manner. If you have seen body parts vaporized into clouds, it really hits home. That was very hard for me to hear. I think people should remember that it was not just the Trade Center. It was 2,500 people or something on that order that suffered this horrendous death.
And a million people probably suffered a nearly horrendous death in Iraq and Afghanistan of the 2 million that were taken out in those countries too.
Yes, yes.
9/11 and the attack on the Twin Towers.
Very true.
Yeah. Gail,
okay. That's your cue. Thought you might be thinking about what to say. So there's a question here from Jean, but it is dependent on watching a little video clip of David Chandler's. So
yeah, I couldn't.
Okay, I didn't think we had enough time for that. And he acknowledged that we may not have time for that.
I'll work on that. If you got another question, we can come back to that.
Okay, and the video that he's asking about, the question is, can you ask Mark what he thinks about David Chandler's minute and a half clip of pieces blowing apart after falling away from the building? So that's the video clip. But the next question is from Ray. And he asked, what is the sound of the combustion of jet fuel in open air? Can it ever create a sonic boom? People who did not see the planes through thought bombs were used. Could it be both were used?
If you just take a tub of jet fuel, you can test it for yourself, right? Go get some kerosene at the hardware store and fill a bucket up with most of the way with water, pour some kerosene on top of the water and light it. There's not much sound at all, right? Now, if that's coming through some kind of an orifice, like the back end of a jet or, finding some tortuous path through a structure of some sort, you're going to get a rumbling, a roaring, a whistling, or that kind of sound. I know I've heard a lot of the eyewitness testimony of people saying they thought they heard bombs, and the ones I've heard, I took it to mean long after the planes had struck, the towers were about to come down or were coming down, which was I think on the order of hours after the actual strike of the planes. So the testimony I've heard about bombs, I've always associated with, and I may be wrong, but I've always associated that with later on when the towers started to come down. you hear, I can't imagine that, you know, a plane striking the side of the building is, you know, is not going to be a very sudden, startling sound that someone might say sounded like a bomb. I can only use my imagination, you know, on, well, okay. I guess that, Richard, this is gory night. Don't invite me back unless you get to put a warning on. A few weeks ago, my brother and I were, I was taking him out to dinner, and we were standing in the parking lot a good distance away from the road, and a motorcyclist at high speed ran into a car at high speed. And it turned out that I was the first responder there, and I've been a first responder for a lot of years because of what I did for a living. And, you know, long story short, you know, we took care of the guy until the paramedics got there. But the sound of that collision was strikingly louder and more punctilious, more punctuated than I would have imagined that to sound. So if I scale that up to a plane hitting a building, that maybe that's what people heard. Can the jet fuel burn and create a sonic boom? No, it can't. Can you get a whistling effect where you get supersonic flow of pressurized gas out of an orifice? Because the pressurized gas is, you know, from the combustion to jet fuel? Yeah, you can. So if you confine it, you can. Unconfined, you can't.
Okay. Now, the last question before that one referred to this video. It's a minute and a half. We want to listen to David Chandler, excellent researcher for 9/11, and he's asking you to comment on it. Okay, here we go.
Sure.
Richard, we cannot hear the video, the audio on the video.
Okay. Well, just watch. I'll tell you what he's saying. So, okay. So you can't hear it either, Mark, right? And our audience can't
very
hear
faint, very faint.
The audience can't hear it either.
I don't know why you can hear it faintly. But anyway, he's saying, I'll tell you what he's saying. Just listen to me. We're going to zoom in on some of these individual pieces of debris. Follow the one in the center. Copious amounts of white smoke. It splits in two right there, and the pieces separate. A little to the right, a second fragment flares as it tumbles right there. And I don't know if it's the upper one or the lower one in the center there. It then splits and ejects a large fragment to the left. That would be the upper one, sort of to the right there. Following the same projectile, we see the left half also splits while emitting a burst of smoke. Both fragments also emit trails of white smoke. One trail leading to the left and the other to the right. From these observations, that it's clear that the white smoke has its clear is sourced from the fragments itself. Evidence of energetic events among the fragments of debris there. So that one lands in your lap, Mark.
That is exactly what it looks like. It looks like something is burning, and it's burning with enough, I guess velocity might be a term. It's burning enough that it's actually producing enough gas to split itself apart. And looking at a couple of those split, and I really hadn't looked at those closely before. So you're getting kind of a live impression here, but seeing some of those splits, it looked like there was a reasonable amount of force pushing those two pieces apart. So it certainly did look like that was a piece of burning fragment of something that is that's splitting itself apart. Now, you know, I've done a lot of, you know, slow motion, high speed video, looking at particles coming off of various explosions. You know, we either a test explosion that we did, and we wanted to see, you know, in slow motion what happened with the particles, or videotape of an accidental explosion. And in all the, you know, probably thousands of hours of video that I've looked at of, you know, high-speed film, slow-motion views of fragments coming off of explosions, I've not seen something come apart like that before. So that makes you think that there's a mechanism could be, you know, something smoldering that then takes off and you have a small explosion. Maybe it's a chunk of concrete breaking up, but that just doesn't appear that way to my eye.
Gotcha. Well, I hope that answers the question there.
Really great question. Thank you.
Yeah. I mean, it looks incredible to me. You can find this, by the way, this video over at 911speakout.org or speakout911.org. How can I make it? One or the other. 911speakout.org or speakout911. I think it's 911speakout.org. Go ahead, Gail.
All right. Last question from Anthony. He asks, what would Mark say about the many eyewitnesses who described hearing and feeling explosions?
Anthony, I have heard quite a few of those, you know, obviously, you know, videos of that. And there's no doubt in my mind they are perfectly consistent with actually hearing explosions. And, you know, if you remember, or at least the ones I've seen, many of them are firemen. Firemen know what explosions sound like. Firemen are trained to recognize that sort of thing. So I see that at face value. They say they heard, they saw, they felt an explosion. I at least in the case of, you know, heard and saw, I gotta say, I 100% believe what the witnesses are saying.
Gotcha. And they're told that these are the sounds of one floor hitting another, you know. Is there a difference between one floor hitting another during a collapse? And by the way, most of these witnesses are talking about explosions that they heard before the collapse of the building, in many cases well before. But is there a distinct difference?
Well, if you can tell the collapse, if you can tell the difference between a thunk and a pow, yes. You know what? Okay. No, literally, the floors collapsing are going to be a duller, flatter, more drawn out sound, and the explosion is going to be a crisper sound that is a little shorter in duration. And I give full credit to the witnesses to be able to tell the difference between the two.
Yeah, especially those witnesses. It was 156. First responders are on record as hearing, feeling, seeing explosions and other phenomena like flashes of light on the towers before they came down. Gail, I don't know why your face is blue, but it's kind of nice.
It doesn't look blue to me from my computer.
Oh, yeah.
Well, it's not blue
over
at all.
Here, you turned blue on us.
Does it look blue to you, Mark?
No, it doesn't. It
looks you're the pretty, only one.
As pretty as it always does.
Oh, okay. You're so sweet, Mark.
Well, she's pretty blue or anyway.
I don't feel blue.
All right. Well, Gail, we're going to thank you for helping us today. And we're going to thank our incredible guest, Mr. Mark Lilly. Thank you so much for coming and enlightening us about all this. Rather horrible evidence. Yeah, great answers to some tough questions, too. Any parting?
Well, I just want to let Mark know there's a lot of comments that I'm not putting in the private chat because they're not questions. A lot of people are commenting it and saying that they really appreciate your answers and how you're answering and your articulation. And yes.
Yeah, great articulation.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you, Gail. I appreciate hearing that.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Now, you were asking for last thoughts, Richard.
Yeah.
I'll
be careful. We have 6,000 listeners.
It's okay.
No. I know this is not a bad one. I won't offend any more listeners. You probably had 12,000 before I started talking about global warming.
But, yeah, no. I wish.
Yes. Here's the thought, and this is sort of technical. I think I mentioned it before. I have investigated and been the principal investigator on dozens and dozens of accidental explosions. The first rule, always, you touch nothing until the investigators get there, photograph everything in place, and nobody moves anything until the investigator has cleared it. That clearly was not the case in the 9/11 situation, and it is unthinkable that anybody who actually wanted to investigate what happened would have scooped all that material up, sent it off to landfills, and sent it off to recycling in China within, I think it was days of the collapse. That, to me, smacks of somebody that either was completely incompetent or somebody that wanted to eliminate evidence of some alternative mechanism.
Wow. That's clear, Mark. I mean, look at this, for instance, because it's in stark contrast to what actually happened. They had 400 truckloads a day removing this evidence from the crime scene, putting it on barges, shipping it to China for recycling before investigators could get their hands on it and do a proper investigation. I mean, would you say that's the illegal destruction of evidence in a crime scene?
Well, yes, and you know, a crime clearly occurred. Whether or not you believe that the Twin Towers fell because of the planes crashing into them, the planes crashing into them was clearly a crime. So there was a crime. So yes, absolutely. And the loss. I mean, every time there's a huge disaster, whether it be in your field of architecture and building and so forth, or whether it's in my field of explosives, we always stop and we learn something from that prevents other people from dying. Mm-hmm. In my former business, we videotaped every single thing we did when we were handling explosives. Why? Because if something happens, I want to warn the next guy.
Excellent. Thank you, Mr. Mark Lilly, explosives engineer. We are much more educated about the World Trade Center disaster than we were before. And I want to thank you, thank Gail, thank all of our listeners so much. You guys have been incredible. And so with that, I'll leave you with this. Oops. Let's start over there.
Thank you for joining us on yet another informative and soul-stirring episode of Richard Gage 9/11 Unleashed. We'll be on the air again next week with another very special guest in the 9/11 Truth Movement and beyond. Visit us at richardgage911.org, where you can find our schedule, learn about the WTC evidence, and, of course, sign up for our emails and support us. Don't forget to like, share, and subscribe.